On this episode of Still Loading, Stratton Studios. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Koval, and today on the show, we have I have a game developer on, my second or third, I think he's actually my third ever game developer. His name is Josh, and little does he know, he's actually battling me out for the title of King of All Joshes. That wasn't even a good joke. We're going to file that. But I have Josh Loveridge here from Stratton Studios and from a bunch of different companies, which I'm sure he will let us know what he does. He's a very busy man. We were talking a little bit off mic that he only sleeps 3 hours a night. And I'm not going to lie, I felt very old because I'm older than him and I can't imagine living off of less than 8. So, Josh, how are you doing today?
I'm doing amazing as always, just loving life and loving what I do, you know?
Well, it's good to hear. Thank you for coming on the show. Thank you for reaching out to me too. I always like meeting new people. So podcasting is great because it is an excuse to have a conversation with someone that you've never met yeah. before. So thank you for coming onto the show. My first question for you though is, I ask this of everyone, what first got you into video games? You said beforehand you're 22, so I'm 32, so we have a 10-year age gap, so this will be interesting for me, especially also, you're from Ireland, so I would like to also hear about that, because that's going to be a totally different culture difference from what I had growing up here in North America. So what first got you into video games?
It's an interesting one, very interesting one. So, fast forward back to my childhood. I was an avid gamer. I suppose I was always one of them guys who necessarily didn't fit in and didn't have, you know, kind of that cliquey mentality, you know, in schools and stuff like that. I was always just into games, you know. I used games as an escapism. I just found the worlds that games provided such a better world than our own at that point for me. Mm-hmm. I just didn't fit into the kind of the way everything worked over here. I didn't enjoy, you know, kind of going out and doing all these things. I didn't enjoy, you know, this whole social circle mentality, you know, just because the people around me just weren't really, you know, I suppose they weren't into the same things I was, you know. Mm-hmm. I was into all these fantasy worlds and, you know, what kind of adventures and the possibilities of the human mind, and everyone else was into, you know, all this other crazy stuff. So, you know, that's what first got me started into games. And I suppose from games, I was exposed at a very young age. You know, I think the first games I ever played was Grand Theft Auto. And that was like, you know, back when it first came out. And I was like, you know, I definitely shouldn't have been playing it. I was like 7 or 8, like, you know, so it was, and I didn't even understand what was going on in it. All I knew was just driving around in a car, really. But, you know, kind of being exposed to that and Crash Bandicoot and all these games, I started to explore the different varieties of genres that was available. And I just realized that I love this. This is, you know, what I love to do. And, you know, then that got me into a cycle of, you know, I used to play games for 12 plus hours a day, as possible. Yeah. And I'd done that for years. And, you know, I didn't realize at the time. Well, I kind of did. I realized at the time, you know, in life, if you want to do something, you have to do it 100%. You can't like half kind of do anything. You have to go full bore at anything. And I was always one of them guys that, you know, 100% at every game, achievement hunting, everything like that. I always had to be the best at it. So, you know, I spent my childhood and most of my teenage years doing that. And then suddenly when I hit around 12-ish, I kind of realized, you know, the world works on money. You know, I got to figure out what I'm going to do with my life. Because at the time I was working
Did you say this was around 12?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's an early realization.
I was always one of them. I think games helped with that too, because in games you always had to, you know, I was into RPGs, and you always had to, you know, get up the whatever the in-game currency was, auction house trading, you know, getting all these things up in like WoW and gold farming and everything like that. You know, I was one of them guys, and I just realized that the world works on a monetary system, and I needed to be able to support myself. And I realized that obviously at 12, you know, you're not going to really need to support yourself, but I knew I had to start thinking in that mentality, because otherwise I'd hit 18 or 19 and it'd be a rude awakening. And I'd end up in a job that I didn't like. So when I hit 12, I got a job in a dog kennels. And I essentially, you know, I don't know if anyone's ever, for anyone that has ever worked in a dog kennels, you know, you spend the majority of your day cleaning up stuff that potentially most people wouldn't like cleaning up. And, you know, I quickly realized that, and I'd done that for a few years until I kind of could fund my own company and stuff. But I quickly realized that, okay, I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. You know, there's a certain aspect, you know, when you're in a pile full of, you know, dog excrement, kind of shoveling it and doing everything like that. You're just like, right, okay, something needs to change. You know, I'm not doing this. This isn't my future. It's the present, but it's not about the present. It's about what can happen. You know, in every good RPG, you know, the main character always starts out, you know, kind of not so good, and he kind of works his way up. So I was like, okay, that's exactly what I'm going to do. So I said, okay, right, I don't want to do this. What do I want to do? And I was like, well, when I come home from work and I'm finished all that, obviously, you know, I've sport and stuff, do martial arts, you know, to keep myself fit. But aside from that, what do I want to do? And I said to myself, well, I love games. I've always loved games. I've spent my life on games. I've spent my life invested in games. I know games inside out. I know everything about them. I don't have a clue how to make them, but it's the only industry I can see myself in and not hating at that time. Mm-hmm. So then, based upon that, I kind of said, okay, well, you know, that's what I'm going to do. So about the age of, I'd say this realization, deciding what I wanted to do, happened about when I was 14 or 15, I decided that's what I wanted to do, and was pursue games as a career. Now, for anyone that doesn't know, the games situation in Ireland is dead. There's only a few companies that are doing it. You could count on one, like two hands, the amount of actual proper companies that are in game, professional game development within the country. There's a few others, you know, and I'm not going to get into the politics of, you know, whose company's doing well and stuff like this, but it's not great. It's not great. You know, a lot of companies, you know, we don't have great supports over here, like from the government, you know, we don't really have sanctioning bodies. There's no kind of legislation. So it's kind of the Wild West at the minute. So there was nothing really happening. Essentially, the mentality and the sentiment was, okay, if you want to be in the game development space, you have to move to Canada or the States. That's essentially it. There's no other option. And I said, and as I've done with everything else, you know, I kind of said, well, no, that's not really what I'm going to do. I'm going to make it work. So I was like, it's possible. And, you know, we'll make it happen. So essentially, based upon hearing all that, I decided, okay, I'm going to do this myself. So I then essentially started out making mobile games. We started out making mobile games, published, I don't know how many of those, I think it was 30 plus of them, you know, learning the craft, learning the trial and tribulations, making mistakes, a lot of mistakes, and learning a lot. And then kind of, you know, we got to a certain point where we decided we were going to make a horror game called The One We Found. And once we made the kind of vertical slice of that title, it ended up getting picked up by Microsoft. It's kind of from there, we've just been evolving and kind of continuing to work with a variety of platforms and just kind of, you know, learning the craft, switching genres, seeing, you know, kind of where we fit within the industry. That's kind of a short and sweet version of kind of how I got into games.
I mean, yeah. well, that literally covered. That's not just how you got into games. That's how you got into games, game design, how you had your awakening that the world is a corrupt place. Like there was a whole story arc in that 10-minute segment there, man. That's crazy though. So that's very surprising. That you knew what you wanted to do at such a young age. It's amazing because I still don't know what the hell I want to do, and I'm 30 fucking two. It's cool though. That's a really good thing because not a lot of people know what they want to do when they're in their teens. Like they don't think that far ahead into the future. So that's really cool. What I wanted to ask though specifically, if we back up a little bit into your
yep.
when you first started playing games before you became a developer, what are some specific gaming memories? Like what consoles did you play a lot on? You mentioned Crash Bandicoot, so I'm assuming PlayStation 1, but was there any, like what was the big, actually I want actually kind of get an idea of what Ireland was like for in the gaming yeah. space back when you were growing up. What was the number one console? You know, like here in the States, you know, in the mid to late 80s, it was the original Nintendo, and then you yeah. know, probably PS1 throughout the 90s, through the mid to late 90s, and then PS2 pretty much through the second half. So like, what was it for you guys?
Yeah, so over here, I suppose, there of course was, you know, the hardcore gamers who were into, you know, the N64, Dreamcast, all these different, you know, kind of mainstream consoles that were really popular in the States. But over here, I would say among the mainstream, kind of, you know, within Ireland, the most popular consoles would have been, you know, your PlayStation 1, PlayStation 2, your N64s, your GBAs, kind of then moving on to your DS, original Xbox, you know, Xbox 360. So it was kind of that. It was really, it wasn't really any of the Ataris or the, it was kind of essentially Sony, Microsoft, and Nintendo. Them, the top three, yeah, really.
Okay, the reason I ask is because I know during the 80s, while the US was obsessed with the original Nintendo, England, I don't know if it was the same in Ireland as well, was really hooked on microcomputers like the ZX Spectrum and stuff like that. So I wasn't sure if there was that in from when you're growing up though, that the, you know, the ZX Spectrum was like way gone. Like it was nowhere near being current or modern. So I just wasn't sure, maybe there was something different that like didn't make it over to the States, because like those microcomputers, that was a huge thing over for you guys, and it was nothing over for us. We had, you know, some PC gaming, some computer gaming, but it wasn't much of anything. Anyway, I just wanted to ask that. So you actually already answered what made you want to get into games. So I guess my next question would be, what were some unexpected challenges or things that surprised you when you started making games? What really, like, what shocked you on being on the other side of the table, I guess?
I suppose the thing that surprised me the most was the amount of trickery and, I suppose, red herrings that you have to throw in front of the player. Within kind of game design and development. And what I mean by that is working within technical limitations to still evoke a scene or emotion that you're trying to invoke without while working within the hardware constraints. That was the biggest kind of realization. It was like, okay, you can't have, you know, a million NPCs on screen all at once, you know, kind of all doing different actions, you know, with all these different particles, you know, just kind of the whole technical limitations, I suppose, would be the biggest kind of shock. That was, okay, now I see why they done this. And, you know, kind of how you have to subtly, you know, put in loading screen, stream different assets and all this type of stuff. It was just a whole different world I hadn't been really exposed to. And I suppose the reason I wasn't exposed to it was because games have done it mostly so flawlessly. That, you know, you just didn't really see, you know, okay, there's actually a massive, like even today, like, you know, Making a game run fluidly at 60 FPS or 30 even is challenging. You know, it's one of them things that is just, it's the crunch period of, you know, development. And it's kind of like, you know, that's where everything gets cut out. That's where all the cool stuff gets cut out, because usually the cool stuff's the most hardware intensive. And so that was Samoa's, yeah.
And I was going to say, and even like I went to school for game design years ago. I realized I like talking about games a lot more than I like making them, because it's fucking hard. It's something that like not, I actually saw a tweet earlier today from Alana Pierce saying that like, and I agreed with it, where it's, you know, why it, she's like, I can't believe I have to say this, but even bad games require an obscene amount of work to make. And usually it's the studios that make them bad, usually. Or the higher ups, the big wigs and whatnot. But it takes an obscene amount of work to make them. It's even the most cut and dry, like people complain about FIFA right now because they don't change a lot in between their yearly iterations.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, that, I mean, you could make that argument, but at the same time, like, there's still a lot of work that goes into these games, and it's not like they can just slap a new label on it and call it the same. Like, it's not like, even if you just change the layout of the menus, that's a whole lot of work, because then there's artists making, there's the UI designer, there's the actual artist, like there's so much that goes into it. And like what you were saying with running stuff on 60 or 30 frames per second, I remember when I was going through game design, it was close to the beginning of the 360 and PS3 era. That's when I was in college going through all that. And that was the first HD gen. And that was the first fully HD generation, with the exception of the Nintendo Wii. And the amount of developers now had to allot more input delay from the controllers, because it was so much, they're just from the nature of things being in HD. Even if the console was built to handle it and there was no like upscaling involved, you usually see that with like old games having to upscale, you see input delay. But even with games designed for an HD resolution, there's more input delay than there was for its 240p counterparts on a CRT television. So it's crazy to me how much goes into this. Anyway, what I wanted to ask next was about one of your specific games. I haven't had a chance to play any of your games. At the moment, you and your studios have designed and published three games, correct? The one we found, Castle Costume and Costume Kingdom.
Yep.
Castle Costume looks really freaking cool. It kind of, it's out on the website for it. It mentions it too, but it's a collectathon game in the same realm of like Banjo-Kazooie and Donkey Kong 64. So I guess my question for that is, I saw the trailer, I saw some of the gameplay stuff, I liked what I saw. What was your inspiration for that? Like, what made you want to create a collectathon game?
Yeah, so I suppose my ethos for Stratton, I suppose, has always been that, you know, we needed to get a niche within the game dev space, and there's not that many niches left. You know, it's kind of, there's a few frontiers that are left to conquer. And one of them frontiers that we are trying to conquer, and we have been since we started, is Halloween themed games, because there's not that many. Really, there really isn't. So that's the niche we try and hone into consistently. So we try to release a game near Halloween every year. But essentially, after the one we found, I suppose, to be brutally blunt, we made a lot of mistakes during that title. And, you know, we quickly realized that we needed to step back and reevaluate what we could do very well on the budgets we were working with. So then I said, okay, right, what games do I love? What games, what games am I obsessed with? And, you know, at the time, I was obsessed with games like Yooka-Laylee, Banjo-Kazooie, A Hat in Time, you know, all these different collectathon titles. And I was like, these were the golden years of, you know, games, really. You know, this was a time when, you know, the industry wasn't as toxic. It was more kind of, you know, it was just a different time. And I suppose it resonated with a lot when I was growing up. you know, all these different games. And it just kind of sparked inspiration in me. And I was like, okay, this is something that I have to create. It was more, it's hard to describe, but it was just as soon as the thought process clicked into my mind, I was like, okay, this is what we have to make. Mm-hmm. A Halloween themed collectathon. And from there, I suppose it was just really, okay, how can we make this fit? And, you know, what's the story arc going to be? You know, kind of what theming are we going to go with? And it just kind of all started kicking off just from that one thought process. But I suppose for inspiration, of course, you've got, you know, all the OG collectathons. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of all chipped in. And, you know, I think that it was an homage to kind of my childhood. Would that be, would be a good
description way to describe it. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
it's cool to see them, to see 3D platformers kind of come up again. Like Yooka-Laylee was one thing, but A Hat in Time, I still have not played, but it looks really freaking cool. I liked what I've seen of it. I wonder if I wish there was more 3D platformers, man. Like there, the new Ratchet and Clank is the closest to a big AAA title that has kind of brought back the 3D platformer, but now it's kind of been molded into what the big open world experience between Horizon Zero Dawn and Insomniac Spider-Man. And I mean, they're great games. I'm not knocking any of them. I love both of those. And, you know, Ghost of Tsushima, though, that's not much of a platformer. But like it kind of toned down the platforming elements. Instead of being about precision and all that stuff, it's much more about the combat, which is fine, but it's I miss the days of 3D platformers. Oh, Mario Odyssey, there we go. That was a big 3D yeah. platformer. But you don't see those too much very often. So I like that you kind of saw that and went with it. I also really like that you guys are going for a Halloween theme. That is a very good observation. There is not a lot of Halloween themed games. And same actually with Christmas. There's not a lot of Christmas themed games. I feel like you guys did the smarter route with Halloween. Like, I'm a Christmas person. I love Christmas a lot, but I feel like making a game around a Christmas theme just comes off as cheesy more than sincere. And Halloween, I think it's a lot more manageable to make a sincere feeling Halloween themed game. One of the other games that you made though was Costume Kingdom. I was a little confused watching the gameplay from this. It kind of seemed like a Pokemon style game to an extent. Am I wrong with that?
Yeah, so it's Costume Kingdom is a strange one. It's kind of a platformer mixed with a monster taming style Pokemon-esque gameplay. So that's kind of the hook for Costume Kingdom. So essentially, what the player does is they're given a quest. So essentially, the player takes on this character called Rayan in this town called Monkchester. This event occurred where essentially all these little kind of monsters called Hollowmon appeared in the town, and there is an evil character trying to essentially, you know, control all the little creatures to ruin Halloween, essentially. And the player has to overcome that by beating different challenges and all this kind of stuff. They go around kind of each house trick-or-treating. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they trick-or-treat in a house, they get a trick-or-treat. If it's a trick, then they're into a battle. If it's a treat, they get candy, you know, kind of. So it's a nice little it's nice if you're into that. Some people, I suppose, the easiest way to describe it, and some people have described it as kind of like Costume Quest mixed with Pokemon mixed with kind of a simple 3D platformer style game. Kind of what it is. So it's a nice little title. It's one of those ones where you play it around Halloween. You know, it's not too long, around 3 or 4 hours, and you know, it's quite a nice little title. There's a lot of kind of, it's quite tongue in cheek. It's got a narrator in it too, so can be quite funny. There's some quite a lot of Easter eggs in there too. So it was a nice little title. I suppose it was the next logical step coming off Castle costume for us. We essentially wanted to improve on a lot of the elements that people didn't like about Castle Costume, and, you know, take that all in our stride and, you know, kind of really hone down on what we can do. And then we've done the same for our current title that we're working on also.
Okay. Now, when for developing these games, do you work on these games yourself? You mentioned off mic you have a couple companies and some of them have, you know, 20 some odd employees. How many people are working on your games in general? Is it just you, or do you have like a small team with you?
So Stratton's quite weird in that aspect. So with us, it depends throughout the year. Right now, during kind of this would be peak, I suppose, crunch period, we'd have a couple guys. So we'd have, you know, we'd have me internally. I'm always, you know, obviously full time on it. And then essentially we outsource contractors in as need be to help us fulfill the roles that we need. So, you know, we might need 3D artists in a time. We might need 2D concept artists. Right now we're working on the reveal trailer for our new title. So, you know, we've got 2D artists in working on that. And then we've got composers. So yeah, it varies. Typically the number, I would say, it typically ranges from about, it can go as low as just two to upwards of 10 at peak periods, you know, just before launch, dealing with all the, you know, launch stuff that you have to deal with. So yeah, it really does vary from time to time, depending on, you know, the period of the year.
How many in-house employees do you have then? Since I would assume it's, because understandably so, like if you are, since you're just still starting out, you can't really afford to hire a lot of people and pay them year round when you're still trying to, you know, build up your brand. So it makes a lot of sense to outsource a lot of the work at the beginning, because you can afford that one time cost versus a full year of a couple, you know, however many. But you guys use pounds, right?
Euro.
Ireland uses euro. The United Kingdom got rid of that's it. You have to pay someone a couple thousand, you know, tens of thousands of euros, whatever the base salary would be, versus just that one time flat payment. So how many people in-house do you have working for your company/companies?
So on Stratton Studio side of things, currently right now, we have two full-time employees all year round.
And your brother?
That's currently, yes. So it's a weird one. And this is a strange one in that, you know, I suppose I have limited Stratton Studios growth in that we've denied a lot of offers from publishers. So I kind of have a rhetoric with game design and development in that there's a certain rabbit hole I won't go down. And that rabbit hole is microtransactions, kind of pay-to-play models. I just don't believe in it. I think it's predatory. I fully am one of those guys who just think
I'm
that,
with
you know,
100%.
Yeah, it's just not good. And I won't grow the company and propel the company based upon something that I don't personally believe in. And I think that ruins the company message. So in that, I have decided, okay, we're not going to do that. And we're going to do this slower. And we're going to do it a different way. After this current title, so the current title we're working on, we haven't revealed it yet. But after this title, we will need to expand. We're just getting bigger. And it's kind of slowly growing. So on the Stratton side, we have two. On Loveridge Digital, we have in total now, it'd be getting up near 20 in-house employees. Offices. Yeah, we've two offices on Loveridge Digital side. So we've one in New South Wales in Australia, and then one over here in Ireland. So that's a much bigger entity. On that side of things, we are involved in the media agency space. So we work on kind of advertising collateral in the advertising space, for high-end brands, essentially. That's what we do.
Okay. So it sounds like Loveridge Digital is kind of like what is at the moment the thing that's helping you pay the bills so you can get Stratton Studios to grow, which, not to say Stratton Studios hasn't been doing well so far, it's just that that's your core moneymaker. Am I correct so far in that? Assuming just based off of employee numbers.
Yeah. So essentially, I've been involved in a few different kind of opportunities, investments that have done very well for me. So I've been the main kind of funder for Stratton Studios. I continue to will be the main kind of, pumping funds into it to keep it going. Leverage Digital, by technically, yes, my income, one of my main income streams would be Leverage Digital. And that's that's one of the bigger entities that I'm involved with. But Stratton Studios, now in saying that though, in the last year, Stratton Studios has become much more self-sufficient in that we are now taking on, contract work from third-party entities.
That's cool.
So we're working on right now we're working on two external titles right now internally. I have a separate team that's dedicated to that, so they're completely different contracts, so I don't really count them as internal Stratton employees, even though technically they are. So on that side of the thing, we've four people currently that are working on an external title that we're kind of building up, so that's kind of going on too for Stratton at the moment, and that will continue to help grow the company and propel it, because it's when you're starting out in the kind of, especially with games and sales, it's tough, selling units is not, especially when you're not going down certain practices that are kind of, the continual generation route, it can be hard to see that ROI on the games.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more about that long-term vision, and what it can become rather than what it is now, and that's kind of the ethos that I've always taken with it. And I know that the route of taking things slower and doing it right rather than jumping the bandwagon and cashing in, so to speak, is much a better route for me personally and for the company rather than rather than the alternate route, which I just don't believe in. I really don't. It's one of those things.
That's really good to hear. I'm with you on the whole doing it the right way, like no microtransactions and whatnot. But that's cool that you have that, you have Stratton Digital to kind of feed into this. Because the reason I even asked that was because the vibe I got, and correct me if I'm wrong, I might cut this out if I'm wrong, so that way it doesn't sound weird. But it seems like this is what you want to do, and Leverage Digital is what you do enjoy it, but this is like your passion. Am I right with that assessment? I'm kind of getting that vibe, or am I off?
It's an interesting one, because I'm a jack of all trades. I suppose that I love. So I started off loving game design and game development, and I quickly learned that I love business too. I love business. And I love growing businesses. I love the whole day-to-day running of businesses. So it's a different love, Games is my internal passion, and that's my internal, if someone said to me, what if you want to do anything on a day-to-day basis, what would it be? I'd probably say, working on games. But on the other hand, I love business, and I love growing businesses. Like, I don't think there'll ever be a time when, even if Stratton Studios was turning over 10 billion a day, I still wouldn't give up my other businesses. I really wouldn't. I love them too much. I love helping people. I love kind of the reward and elements of that too. So I love the grind. That's really it. I love the day-to-day operation. I love the challenges that brings, and the inspiration that brings to the games. Because, there's a lot of inspiration that can be taken from the other work that I do into the game side of things. And, I could never see a time where I'm working solely on one rather than both. I love both, and I love them in different ways. I suppose games is what started everything for me, so I could never give up games. And Loverage Digital is what made it happen, so I That's could really never cool. give that up either. So yeah, it's an internal love for both of them. I love both the spaces, and they're different love, but different creativity. You know, they're both creative in their own ways. Like, you know, for example, on the Loverage Digital side of things, we've worked Disney, you know, working with Ferrari, McLaren, all these big brands, and you know, to kind of get to work on some of the really big IP is really cool. And it's really cool to collaborate on that material. So it's very enjoyable, I have to say.
That's really cool, man. I think that's an important balance too, because I love podcasting, right? I love doing this. So if I could somehow make this a living, I 100% would. But at the same time, I think I'd still get a part-time job. I'd still get something to kind of like, I need that separation. I need something where it's like, I love doing this, but I want to get something else that like almost feels like I have to do it. Not saying that's how you feel about Loverage Digital, but like I have to go do my job at the grocery store. That's not where I work now, but I have to go do that because even though it's not my favorite, it gives me, it's almost that juxtaposition where it's like, I love podcasting that much more now because I have to go do something that I like less. Now, once again, not saying that's your feelings about between Stratton and Loverage, but that balance I feel like is important, because then you're not getting tired of one thing. You're able to switch those mental gears and being able to try different things. That's really cool. So what has been your experience working with some of these bigger companies? Like you mentioned, you worked with Disney. What did you do for Disney specifically? Or are you not allowed to say? Is that all under NDA stuff?
It's specifics I'm not allowed to go into. I can talk about IPs that potential that we've worked on. So we've worked on some of the advertising collateral for the Star Wars franchise. You know, some of the kind of more classic Disney films. So, you know, we've worked on stuff for them, and mostly to do with their parks. So, you know, so some of the, you know, in the parks, you see these little like yokes that are like on screens where they're trying to like, kind of sell you like paintings and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
So kind of the nice graphics for that. We've worked with them in a few ways, worked on some, you know, kind of, this is how I describe my relationship with a lot of the bigger guys, because the bigger brands, and here's an interesting bit about them, and they never mind me saying this, at least they haven't told me they have anyway. So they are very specific about who they want. They don't want your employees to do it. They don't want anyone else. They say, we want you for this project. If anyone else is touching it, we don't want it. Only you are allowed to work on this. That's the way a lot of my relationships is with them, because they want a certain level of quality in their work, and they want guarantees based upon you can do this within this time. And a lot of the times kind of my relationship sparked with a lot of these big brands is essentially when someone else messes up, and they are in a hot spot, like, you know, kind of position where they need, like, say, for example, they send us a project on a Friday. They get a return from the agency they're working with. The agency has messed up, or their internal designers have messed up, and they're off now. They're not back till Monday, but they need to put the collateral out on Monday, and they need changes to be done by Monday. So they have to get someone who they know is going to finish it and who's going to pull them crazy hours to get it done for them. And that's always what we've been used for, essentially, is the Fallout guys to, you know, come in, get it done. He knows exactly what he's doing. He'll get it done. He'll get it sorted. And, you know, kind of that's how my relationship has grown with them. Now, I suppose my relationship is, I have a great relationship with a lot of the high end execs, and they kind of, you know, we get projects anytime, you know, kind of we want them, really. And we're, on the Loveridge side of things, we're always flat out busy. Like, we're just continually scaling and growing. Like, in the last year, we have grown 300%, like, alone. So it's madness, absolute madness. And yeah, it's that just allows, it gives me the creativity to then bring into games, because I get a lot of exposure to the latest technologies that are being utilized, like motion capture, all these different, like virtual productions, all this different stuff, you know, kind of we're working with. And it just allows us that kind of dynamic ability in our work. And the interesting bit is, and this is kind of, it's kind of related to games, in that the kind of whole film production space and advertising space is moving to utilize game development engines like Unity and Unreal through virtual productions. So a big area that a lot of these high-end studios are looking for is guys that know kind of game development and know how to build these areas. Yeah, so for us, it's kind of like, and now that's kind of the new take on it with these companies. They're like, oh, you've been running a game dev thing for years? Oh, okay, so you can do that for us too. Great. You know, we can utilize this. You know this space. We're looking to build out a team. Can you come in and show us how to do this? Yeah, like that's kind of how it's moving now. So listen, it's worked out amazing. They kind of go hand in hand. And that's why I say that I'd never give up either or, because eventually I see them kind of meshing together in a weird kind of, you know, way. And might be 10, 15 years down the line. But it's an interesting one. And so that's my relationship with them on the Loveridge side. On the Stratton side of things, It's a strange one. So we've interacted with a lot of the bigger AAA companies, and how we've interacted with them has always been through I've got connections with them through Loveridge. So, you know, I'd meet someone who kind of, you know, I'd be working with an exec for one company. He'd know a guy who works in, you know, kind of this company, and it kind of through word of mouth kind of passes along. And then I get in touch with them, get talking to them, and then I'd be talking to them about games. And then they might say, oh, we're having this specific problem at the moment. Would you come in on a contract basis just to get this problem sorted? Typically, you know, one of the areas that I'm specifically talented in is getting a project over the line on a tight timeline, and knowing how to, I suppose, quickly sift through the tasks that are most important rather than, you know, kind of, okay, we can cut that out, that's not needed, let's just focus on this bit, you know, to get it over the line. That's one of the areas I'm specifically talented in. And yeah, so a lot of the bigger companies have found that very useful, especially when it comes to games that are stuck in development hell. So just a quick, you know, kind of maybe 3-4 hour call to see where they're at, and to kind of, you know, give them the heads up. Okay, this is what I would recommend you move to, you know, push that off, move this here. You know,
help kinda them prioritize the list of like what is the, yeah, I get that. Especially my wife, it's not related to gaming, but whenever you see a big project, a lot of people tend to get overwhelmed. My wife, it happens a lot to her. So I'm like, stop thinking about the whole project. Let's break it down to individual parts. What's the most important part? Do that right now. And that's a good skill to have, man, because that's good outside of game development as well, for prioritizing, even just fucking if you need to move your house, you know what I mean? Like, you can figure out the best way to do that. What's it like to work with Sony and Nintendo? And actually Xbox and Microsoft, because you've published games on all of them. I believe your first game, the one we found, is on Xbox. Castle Costume, is that on Switch as well? I know it's on PS4. I know, so one of your games is on Switch, right?
No, actually. They were meant to be on Switch. So with Switch, our game was slated for release on Switch. We started development on it, nearly got it there, but we ran out of budget. Couldn't get it over the line, so we had to shelve it. In saying that, though, our current title, you know, we are pushing for the Switch and PlayStation also. So I'm very confident we're going to get it over the line for both this time round. The main reason we didn't go for Switch on Costume Kingdom was because the players didn't. Everyone wanted it on PC instead. Mm-hmm. And that was the player consensus among our player base. So we went for a PC release instead of Switch.
Okay.
Which, looking back on a retrospective, was a bad decision. But listen, you live and learn. So the games haven't been on Switch as far. We're aiming for it. Switch is Nintendo. So Nintendo right now to publish a game on is kind of... It's gotten a lot easier over the years. Back when I first kind of signed with Nintendo, it was a private thing. Like, it was a private, okay, you had to get a contact in Nintendo. You had to get these, you know, kind of, you had to set up with these meetings. No one knew who to get in touch with. So it was really hard. And, you know, we kind of got in very early. We were one of the beginning people to get a dev switch, all that type of stuff, you know, kind of working on that hardware. And one thing I will say about Nintendo, now we haven't ever fully published the game on them, but I will say is they've been very patient in that they haven't been annoying us, say, all right, guys, when he's getting a game out, you know, we've extended your dev license for these so many years, you know, and you haven't put out anything. What's going on? Like, it's never been that. It's always been take your time. We know it takes time to, you know, do things. So take your time with it. You know, let's get something wait till it's right, and then we'll move ahead with it. So in that far, I can never say a bad thing about Nintendo. Great company, great ethos, and yeah, so I'm looking forward to working with them more in the future, which we should see over the next few months specifically, because as I say, we are working on our new IP. Microsoft was the first company we had a relationship with, and then it was Sony, but Microsoft I've had mixed opinions on, both publicly and privately. I suppose...
Well, I don't want to get you in trouble with anyone, so if...
No,
Don't feel forced to say anything that's going to get you in trouble with any of the companies.
No. Like, as I say, my opinion... I'm honest with my opinion, and the guys at Microsoft, after I voiced my opinion, like, after speaking with them and seeing it, I changed my opinion. So about a year back, I did an interview. I didn't say anything relatively bad. I just kind of said, listen, you know, I stopped working with Microsoft based on creative differences, in that, you know, we wanted to do something and it was kind of a hard no. It was like, no, not happening on our console type thing. Whereas the other console provider said, yeah, okay, we'll allow you to explore this. Maybe it's not going to work, but listen, we'll let you do it. So that was that was my only objection against them. But in saying that, and having spoken with them in the meantime, my opinion has changed. And listen, it's just business. And a retrospective on that decision that they made was, it was a better decision, in that they were just trying to guide us in the right direction. Maybe we didn't know it at the time, but they were just, their goals were in the right place, and that they had our best interests at heart. And I respect them fully for that. And I will work with them again in the future. Right now, I'm not looking to publish any titles on their platforms. Mainly because I suppose the genre that we're working on just doesn't fit, in that, you know, kind of Microsoft and Xbox is mainly, you know, kind of the audience is more targeted towards shooters, open worlds, you know, kind of it's more that just the, like, the age range doesn't really line up for who we're aiming with, you know.
Yeah.
Right now it doesn't anyway, so that's the only reason currently. Other than that, I can't say a bad thing to say about them. I love what they're doing for developers. They, in the last couple of years since I've worked with them, they've changed their ethos completely. Like, you know, they're doing, pulling out funds for devs to help support them. They're doing really cool things, and they, you know, listen, they've all my support, and yeah, great company. Great company, really doing great things. So they've improved. They're constantly listening. You know, it takes a lot for a company after someone says something about them to kind of say, okay, how can we make this better? You know, how can we amend this? And any company that'll do that, that they have my full support. So yeah, great company, Microsoft. Sony, I've nothing but great things to say about Sony. On our first title, the one we found that was slated for release on PlayStation. Again, budgets caused issues not to get it out. And Sony literally were just like, that's fine. Yeah, listen, we're still here waiting. And they waited. They waited a lot longer. Like, for example, the original title that didn't work out on Xbox was Castle Costume. That was the original concept, and they kind of, Sony were open arms and said, listen, let's give it a go. You know, and in the meantime, I suppose, you know, you'll see a lot of things in the news lately about Sony and, you know, kind of not supporting indie devs and being a small fish, you know, all this type of stuff. And, you know, I've always found Sony to be very open and welcoming. They are there if you ask for the help. You have to ask. You have to be, you have to put your hand up and say, listen, I need support. I need you guys to help. What can I do to increase our working relationship? You know, how can I improve that? What can I do on my end? Because it's a two-way street. And then, you know, what kind of things start to open up. But Sony really proved to me, and I can't say specifically what Sony did, but when coronavirus hit, Sony were there for a lot of companies. And as I say, I can't say specifically what they done, but I'll put it this way. What they did specifically saved a lot of companies. Saved a lot of companies. It didn't save Stratton. We weren't in a difficult spot, but I know a lot of guys that were saved out of what Sony did. So Sony, I have my loyalty forever for doing that. They were one of the only companies that did. And yeah, so I love Sony too. You know, some people say that's, you know, games are harder to sell on PlayStation. I will give it that. You know, they just, yeah, it's just a difficult sell. But you know, they all have challenges in their own right. And I think that's, you know, kind of the ethos of, you know, competitors. You know, some platforms are going to have different challenges. Some platforms are going to have others. And just like anything, you know, that's just the way it is. So, yeah, I like all the platforms. I've experienced a lot of them. I've even done a little bit of work on Stadia and stuff like that back when that was a thing. So yeah, it's good. Like, you know, there's a lot of, I have a wide experience with all the platforms, and I can't say wholeheartedly that one particularly stands out in a way that, you know, demolishes the other. I think each platform has its own pros and its own cons, and it will continue to have, because no one's perfect, and I don't think anyone can ever reach being perfect. I think there's always room for improvements, and yeah, so it's great. I think the industry is in a much better position than it was a couple of years ago, 100%, especially for developers that are kind of starting out. It's a great spot to kind of launch pad off. I mean, back when I started, it was a bit of a boneyard, really. No one really, you know, even like, you know, kind of, we didn't have IARC, you know, fully in place for rating games. You know, it was all a bit tricky going out to the different boards and getting, you know, your games rated. It was very costly, you know, all that's starting to kind of come into place now. So it's good. And we've got more regulation, specifically around, you know, kind of microtransactions, what can't be done, you know, so the space is starting to get cleaned up a good bit, and I like it. It's been a nice alignment as well for Stratton, because we're starting to go from a, you know, kind of, okay, where are these guys? Are these guys going to stay? Are they going to fold? You know, we're starting to kind of pass over that couple year line where it's okay, they're here to stay. And it's, you know, it's just, as I always say to anyone about Stratton, it's like, it's not an if we will succeed, it's a matter of when. And that's really a thing. And I think it's the same thing with consoles also, you know, it's mm-hmm. just really ever evolving.
One quick second. I have one or two more questions for you, but my wife just got home. Just want to make sure everything's all good. And then I'll be back, ask the last couple questions, and then we'll be good to go. Thanks for waiting there.
No worries at all.
Oh, excuse me. This has been fun though, man. Thank you for coming on.
No, it's no worries at all. As I say, I always love talking to new people and getting new people's perspectives, because it's one of the only social interactions that I get, because I'm always working. So I'm either really working with clients or doing interviews. So it's kind of,
it's a good way to turn work into a social experience, into meeting someone new and becoming friendly with someone. It's like podcasting. I'm always at a weird impasse with it, because I don't like self-promotion, which is why I'm not a good businessman. I feel very self-conscious, because I don't want someone to think that the only reason I'm talking to you is so I can make money or so I can gain exposure.
Yeah, no, it's that line's a very hard one to kind of jump around, and that's something I've struggled with too, because I don't like that. I don't like using people. My mentality is always give twice as much as you get. That's just the way I've always approached business. And yeah, so that is one of those things. And I suppose it does inhibit growth. And that's one of the reasons Stratton as well isn't where it is, because I won't use the players. I don't look at the players as, I went to a conference once and I was disgusted. I'm not going to lie. I speak at a lot of conferences in the game dev space.
Have you gone to GDC before?
I haven't made the jump to GDC yet. I've just always been so busy. I spoke at a couple, we've had a couple spots like DreamHacks and stuff like that. And I was speaking at a conference once, and one of the guys from Kinguin was there. I don't know if you know about Kinguin. It's like CD, G2A. It's like G2A.
Kinguin's the one where you can buy like other people's CD keys, and you get them through somewhat legal, not legal means.
So essentially, I was speaking, and it was like the guy who was speaking there was doing like a thing. It was like the name of the keynote was like turning players into payers, and I was like, oh sweet Jesus. And they concocted this formula called the Arpdale formula, and it's actually a formula for extracting maximal revenue out of addictive personality players. And I was like, what in the name of God are you guys like pushing? I was like, this is ridiculous. I was like, you can't be doing that. Like, so I disagree with a lot of that. And it was actually quite funny, because the guy who owned Kinguin was there, and I approached him. I was like, hey, your website sells keys to my game, but I've never actually, you know, interacted with you in any way. Where'd you get them? And he was just like,
that's so shitty. I kind of want to keep that in. I'm going to find a way to keep that part in.
it was kind of like, so a lot of them, and it wasn't his fault. Listen, it was these websites. What happens is, so when you're doing press releases, kind of your press thing for your upcoming game, you give out keys. You give out like review keys. But a lot of these big YouTubers, they don't play the games. So like a guy with 300,000 viewers that only plays Call of Duty will request a key for your game. And True Keymailer is the website that, you know, people commonly use, or Game Press or whatever it may be. But they request a key, but they've no interest in playing it. And what they do then is they just list them on like G2A or CD keys. So the review keys, and they sell them. And that's essentially what a lot of these influencers do. So that's why, like, you
that's
know,
really
when an influencer...
Shitty. That's really yeah. fucking... So when, like...
yeah. So when an influencer requests our key for our game, like, for example, what we do is we always say to them, yeah, no worry, we'll give you as many keys. Because then they don't just ask for one key. Usually they ask for, like, five or six. Like, they'll ask, oh, can we get five or six keys? We want one for ourselves and then a couple to give away, which is fine. You know, typically to give away to people, that's 100% fine for a bit of like 100%, that's okay if they're actually going to do it. So what we usually do is we get them to message us on social. socials if they're actually legit, and we most of the time we never hear back, because in our first title we had 13,000 stolen units in total. That was the number. So on day one, our PC sales on the one we found were zero sales, but there was 13,000 active instances of players on the game, and we were tracking that through the dashboard. And I was just like, oh, so it's like, just that's like, oh, well, awful. There goes a...
That's so... There goes... Just so shitty, dude. Like, that's so awful. I can't believe... Like, I can't even imagine releasing a game and seeing 1,300 or 13,000 or 1,300.
13,000.
Holy fuck. 13,000 people. And you didn't see a single fucking euro, excuse me.
Yeah. And here was the funny bit. Here was the hilarious bit, right? And this cracked me up. I was like, oh my God, this is hilarious. One of the people that got it found a bug in the game, and they were complaining about it. And I was like, you don't really get a right to, because they put a comment in the Steam, like, you know, the Steam, like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Comments. They put a comment saying, oh, you know, can you help me with this bug or whatever? And I just commented back and I was like, hey, yeah, sure, no worries at all, but you have to buy the game first. You know, we haven't actually sold any units yet, so I'm not sure how, you know.
You got this copy.
You're not on our press list. So can you, you know, elaborate? And I never got a reply back. But it was hilarious because it was even funny. I found one of the websites that they were distributing this game, the game on. It was on OpenSea, is I think the game OpenSea Games or something was the website, one of these scammy sites. Anyway, I went on it and there was like 150 comments of like all these people like bashing the game, and I was just like, this is hilarious. I was like, I just can't imagine stealing something from someone and then complaining about it. It's like,
you literally, it always bothers me. Like, I have no issue when people dislike a game. You're going to dislike games. You're going to find things that it's like, nah, this just doesn't hit me the right way. Or maybe objectively, it's just a shitty fucking game. But regardless, that stuff happens, right? But I don't like, there are very few pieces of media that I can willingly just shit all over, that I can, sorry, that sentence just was really weird, but I will willingly just like bash to no end and not give an actual fair and balanced level of criticism, right?
Yeah.
It's one of those things where it's like, you need to, like, don't just say a game sucks. Tell people why you think it sucks, like, and be specific. And you can say, it always bothers me when people have to like say things meanly. Like, you can give criticism without being an asshole. You can say, yeah, the controls were floaty, or the and a lot of it is, it's harder to tell in text, but you can write it in text, like, the controls were floaty, so it was hard for me to control the character. Or maybe there's too many ice levels and it's not fun to not have full control of your character for two-thirds of the game or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, it's stuff like that. Like, you can give objective, fair criticism, but without shitting all over it. The only time I think I've ever like been so mad, and it wasn't even a game, but I was so mad at a movie. So mad at a piece of media. It was the Last Airbender movie, Avatar: The Last Airbender.
Oh yeah.
And I have never been so mad at something in my life. That's not about video games though. We're going to get back to this. So I have two questions for you, Josh. Two final questions. One, if you could, they're kind of connected. What would be a dream game for you to make? Like budget's no issue. Like, if you could make a specific game, like, don't give away a game idea, because obviously, you know, you can make, but like, what style of game would you want to make, I guess? And then kind of a follow-up to that, if you were commissioned, you know, a company outsourced to Stratton Studios to make them a game, what would be an IP that you would love to work on?
That's actually something that we discussed quite a bit in the company. Because there is a couple IPs that have came across our desk to work on. You know, one of them was being the Smurfs at one point. We turned that away because it's just not, it just didn't feel right at the time, especially the game that was trying to be made. It was a mobile game and microtransactions again. But anyway, so the game, and this is actually, you know, a lot of people are going to say this is, you know, you're crazy for saying this, but the style of the game I would love to be remembered for. And that is, I suppose, the thing that I'm trying to build with my life. And that's my life goal, is to build a legacy and to build a, okay, this, you know, when I'm not here anymore, I want people to be like, that is the guy who worked like a demon and, you know, continued to work. And he just grinded out. He had a vision and he wasn't letting anyone get in the way of that vision. And he got it in the end. And, you know, there's something to be admired from that. And potentially down the line, you know, I want someone to be like me when I was started and to see the kind of the path, because the path's been documented. My path kind of thus far has been very well documented. To kind of look at it and say, okay, I can do that too. And that's something I want to achieve. So one of the games that I feel that I would want to would be a collectathon like Yooka-Laylee, or that was received very, very well. That would be the style of game that I would like to be remembered for. And a lot of people didn't like Yooka-Laylee. They thought it was, you know, there was many, some people had many issues, but that's the style of game. You know, there's just something about that kind of, I suppose the innocence of the game, the innocence of the characters, the innocence of the world, you know, the take on capitalism within the game, and, you know, the subconscious little, you know, jokes that they put in now and then, that tongue-in-cheek humor. I love that. And it's just that style of game, and that kind of, even the art style, you know, when I even think about that game, it just gets me fired up. It just like ignites like a flame in me, and it's just like, yeah, that's what I would love. Like, as I say, and I always say to Uriah, you know, internally, I'm like, if I ever do that, I can walk away. I can walk away from game development and I can say, okay, I've done this, because I'm not doing this for money. I really amn't. You know, if I was solely driven on how much I was making, you know, listen, you know, it becomes a non-objective once you've, you know, put it this way. If I wanted to retire, I could. Like, if I wanted to retire, I could fully retire. You know, I've done very well in certain other things, and that's okay. You know, it's not, money's not a thing. I don't spend a lot of money. You know, I still, you know, since I started this whole thing and my uprise, I've never increased how much I spend. I am not driven by, you know, merchandise. I am not driven by monetary things. I don't like going on holidays. I don't like all this stuff that a lot of people work for. All I need is a bed, a computer, and, you know, health insurance if I ever get sick. Yeah, food, health insurance if I ever get sick, you know, a car under me, and then I'm good. You know, I'm happy. You know, so it's money isn't the thing. It's, for me, it's about having created something that I'm proud of. Because while I'm proud of the games that we've made, they haven't hit where I wanted them to hit. They haven't achieved what I wanted them to achieve. And it's not a number of units that I want to be sold. It's not about that. It's about the response from players that it gets. It's about that, you know, kind of cult following that, you know, it's just something about it. And even like it's not a matter of, okay, it has to hit that number of sales. It'll just be, once I create something like that, I'll know. It's just one of those things, you know, okay, I've done it. Like, you know, like, for example, the guys who made A Hat in Time, you know, they've done it. They've, like, if I made something like A Hat in Time, I could walk away. I could say, listen, you know, kind of, you know, we've done this. Would I walk away? Probably not, but I could, and I'd be happy, and I'd be content with what I've achieved. Right now, I'm not content. You know, we're constantly improving, constantly working on. And each time we publish a game, we realize, okay, we had flaws. You know, we weren't perfect in this dev side. We maybe thought we were, but we weren't. And that's going to continue to happen. You know, while I feel on our current title that we're working on, which is a 2D monochromatic 2D. Platformer. Yeah, 2D monochromatic platformer.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's a weird title, because monochromatic is a very difficult thing to do well.
That's like all just blacks and grays, right? Black, white, and gray, right?
Black, white, and gray. So we've published some kind of teasers for that on our Twitter. And yeah, so if anyone wants to go take a look at that, they can. But yeah, so we're working on that at the moment, and that's a very interesting kind of element. Like, one of the things that a lot of our last previous two games missed has been their story. They haven't had the most advanced story. There hasn't been that kind of plot twisty stuff in them, whereas this one does. This one's a very narrative driven title, and it's going to hit home with certain people. You know, so we're constantly improving and constantly working towards something like achieving that kind of, you know, success with our titles. But, you know, I think it'll always evolve for me. I really think it will. You know, I don't think, like, I don't foresee me ever wanting to retire, I suppose, would be the ever thing. I just can't see myself doing it. I love the work. See, I always say to people, it's not about the end result that you achieve. It's about the journey. It's about the steps. Like, if you're not loving the steps you have to take to get to something, you're doing it all wrong. You're in the wrong space. Because what we realize is, and I can tell you from achieving a lot of goals in life that I set early on, was that once you reach that goal, you're just going to find another goal. So if you're constantly goal hunting, you're never going to be content in what you're doing. You have to really love the process, and you have to love the daily bits of it. Like, for example, you know, it's like, for like, you know, when someone gives a review for a game, I love that. I love, like, you know, receiving that feedback, receiving that, okay, these are elements that we can improve with. I don't have to come up with these elements. We're being told what people want. You know, it's just such an interesting thing. Even, you know, working on bugs in game, like, a lot of developers, you know, say crunch time in game development. You know, it's a big thing in game dev, crunch. You know, everyone hates it. I love it. I love crunch time. I love when you're in the weeds with the game. I love it. I just think there's something empowering about it. There's something, you know, it's like climbing a mountain that seems maybe unattainable at first, but then once you slowly start to take each step, it becomes, you know, ever so closer to the end result. And I just love it. I love all the process of it. I love working. That's really it. To me, it's not work. It's just, like, I get to wake up every day and do exactly what I love and help other people do what I love, you know, and there's an empowering thing in that. And I feel that a lot of people in the game dev space are maybe in it for the wrong reasons, and that maybe have different goals, which is okay. You know, if you're in it just for the wage at the end of the week, that's fine. You know, but I suppose the true innovators in the space and the true people that made this industry great is the people that done it not for the monetary gains, but for the love of creation and the love of the process. Like, even someone like John Romero, he's over here, he's based 2-3 hours away. And, like, he's still making games to this day by himself, but he's not publishing them. Well, he has a company that published some Romero games, you know, Empire of Sins, but he still works on get, like, I'm friends with him on LinkedIn or Twitter or whatever it is, and I seen he went on holiday the other day to a place in Galway there, and you know, the picture that he posted, he brought his Mac with him, and he was like, finally get to work on some concepts that I had in mind. He's doing it not because, you know, he's being forced to work on his holiday. It's doing it because he loves what he does. He loves the process. And that is the bit that is just, you know, I love.
I think it's hard. Like, it's you're in a very fortunate position that you can control what you do every day versus people who are in the, like, imagine working on what's your least favorite game genre? Not throwing any shade to the genre, just something that really doesn't connect with you.
I would say the genre that would be the most tea pulling to work on, would be,
doesn't even have to be one to work on, but one that, like, you wouldn't want to play yourself. Take out the dev side.
I'd say probably FIFA. Let's go with something like FIFA.
Oh, perfect. That's actually
not into soccer.
So imagine you get hired by EA to work on the next FIFA game. You don't like FIFA games, not your cup of tea. You say this actually is a great example too, because when I was in game design, when I was in college taking classes, our 3D modeling teacher, he worked for EA for a little while, and he got offered a job there for the Madden games, and his entire job was going to be working on the grass. That's it. Nothing else. So imagine you wake up every morning, you have to, whether you're working from home or going into an office, your entire day is grass. You have to work on making the pitch look as nice as it possibly can, you know, how the play, when a player steps on the grass, how it bends, that's all you get to do all day long. You would go crazy because you're working on a game you don't really give two shits about. You're working on like probably something really tedious and not necessarily the most fun. Like, I'm not denying that it's challenging by any stretch, but like you've positioned yourself to be in a good spot where you are working on stuff you want to do all the time.
Yeah.
And that's great, because not everyone gets that chance to do it. And you worked your ass off to get it. I mean, like we were saying before, you get 3 hours of sleep a night, which I still think you're insane for, but you get 3 hours of sleep a night. And so you have worked your ass off to get to a spot where you can do that. I don't think you would enjoy working for a big AAA company. If it was a company that constantly made games that you like, collectathons or something like that, but it's very different. Like I feel like the crunch is fun for you because you love every single moment of what you do. Imagine crunch time working on grass. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, and everyone always says it. Like, a lot of people do say it to me. They're like, you would be terrible working with another company. You would be absolutely the worst. And the reason being is because my mentality is, I'm very brutally honest. Probably a little too honest for some things. But yeah, I'm brutally honest. And if I think something's, like, if I am given a, like, it's set right. If I was in that position and that job and I had no other options, I wouldn't do it. I'd say no. I'm going to do something I like. And that is just that. I'm going to find a way to make it work. Like, but I suppose I understand a lot of people are, you know, they have families and stuff like that to support and they have to do it. They've no choice. But I don't. Like, I never have taken that on because I know that once, I suppose for me, it's a matter of, I know that once I get responsibilities in that, I'm not just looking after myself, I can no longer have that ability to say no to things. And that's something that I'm not prepared to do currently. I think that's the thing though too. Like, you know, that's why I've worked 18 hours a day, is so I don't get myself into those positions and that I don't have to do that. I can pick and choose, you know, what we're doing, where we're going. And I think that's why the company's never partnered with a publisher thus far, is because I won't do things that I feel are predatory. I won't do maybe elements that I think are just pure wrong. And yeah, I think that is a thing within the space. Like, you know, a lot of the the guys, and a great example, like, bring back to John Romero. That's why he left id back in the day, and Doom, was because he just had enough of it. He was just like, no, I'm not doing that. Like, you know, I don't want to do it. I'm not enjoying this, so it's time to walk away. And, you know, I think to achieve that luxury, because it is a luxury. Like, I 100% understand that I am one of the luckiest people alive to be able to do what I do and love it on a second basis, and I'm very grateful for that. But I suppose I think the reason I've been able to achieve that is because I had that vision very early on, and that I knew that to be able to do that, it was going to take a lot of work, and it still takes a lot of work. Like, you know, like, as I always say to everyone also, it's all about the players, you know, like, without our players, we're nothing. And if our players just decide one day, listen, we're not buying their games anymore, we're done. And that's really, you know, it. So it is an interesting one. And, you know, 100% I do understand. And I know a lot of people working in the bigger AAA companies, especially when it comes to crunch, like, you know, like, perfect example, when COVID hit, I know some of the guys at, like, Capcom were, like, forced to, like, stay in the office and stuff like this. And, like, all these crazy stuff. And I'm just like, you know, if I was ever in a situation like that, I'd be out the door. I'd be like, no, sorry, see you later. Not going to happen.
I mean, and it, like you were saying, like, you, if you are responsible, like, I couldn't do that with my job. Like, I like my job, so I'm very grateful for that. I'm not even just saying that because I put this on the internet. I do really enjoy my job, like, the thing I actually can make a living off of. But if that job ended up getting really shitty, it would take a long time for me to find a new place to work, because I need to find a place to be able to, that can pay me enough to provide for my wife and my kid, as well as health insurance for all of us. And it's a lot. Like, there's a lot to take into account. Anyway, we're running a little bit long. So to wrap all of this up, is there anything you would like to promote? Is there anything that you would like my listeners to go check out? I'm not going to lie, personally, Castle Costume looks really fucking cool, because I'm a sucker for those collectathons as well. Banjo-Kazooie is one of my favorite games. Donkey Kong 64, I adore it. That's a little bit too heavy on the collectathon side, but I still love that game. So I'm probably going to pick this up at some point once I save up. It's not that expensive. It's only $10 that I saw too.
Yeah, no, I think it'll be going on sale. I wouldn't pick it up right now. I'd pick it up in like a couple of weeks. We should be in the summer sales, which I think we're putting it down to like two.
Perfect. I might pick that up then, because it looks great.
Yeah.
What would you like to promote? What do you want the listeners to check out?
I suppose right now, you know, you can check out our previous titles. And as I always say to everyone, if there is someone out there who maybe is not in a financial position right now to and would like to try one of our games, just drop us a DM. We're always more than happy to give someone a code if they aren't in a position right now. You know, it's not that's one of the things that I'm very, you know, kind of, I like to do a lot is to, if someone can't afford our games, just tell us and we'll give you a copy, because paying it forward is a big thing. And I personally believe in that a lot. But with regards to our titles, I suppose just maybe give us a follow on Twitter or one of our social channels if that interests you. You know, we're always posting updates to what we're doing there. You know, we recently got into the NFT space. So if anyone's interested in NFTs or anything like that, you know, you can check that out on our Twitter. But yeah, we'll be announcing our newest game in a couple weeks. Maybe more than a couple of weeks, probably a month or two. And we're hoping to release it before the end of the year. As I say, it's a 2D monochromatic platformer. And yeah, it's going to be a nice little title. If you're interested in kind of single player narrative driven games that are kind of abstract and maybe a little bit different from the normal kind of thing that's out there, it should be coming to Switch and PlayStation. We don't know if we're going to be doing PS5 or which one yet. Well, I mean, just follow our socials, really, and you'll see updates to what we're doing, because we post there daily. And also, we have a YouTube channel, if anyone's interested in that. We do Game Dev React, so essentially, I watch a bunch of trailers, and, you know, we post some videos there, and, you know, yeah. Or just join our Discord, you know. We're a very open community, very good vibes, you know. I mean, if anyone has ever any questions or anything like that, my DMs are always open. I'll never try to sell you anything or shill anything. I'm not into that. I'm just into, you know, helping the community and growing the community together, because I'm a big believer in that if one person grows and they're part of my network, it's good for me in the long term, because you just never know. You really just never know what can happen and who someone, you know, what may happen in the future for that person. And you never know what someone's going through either. So, you know, I'm a big believer in also that, you know, always try every day, try to make someone's life a little better. Because you know, it can be a bit of a tough world out there, and it can be a little harsh at times. So always try to be nice to everyone, and that's what we do also. So yeah, that's really it.
All right. And for those who are wondering, that is at Stratton Studios on Twitter and Instagram, right?
Yeah.
All right, cool. As usual for me, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. If you want to contact me, you can email me stillloadingcontact@gmail.com. If you want to support the show, you can do that in a number of ways. Give it a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use. That helps more people find the show. If you want to support it monetarily, you can go to patreon.com/stillloadingpod. Even just $1 a month will help grow the show. And finally, the most important thing I have to mention is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of children receiving inpatient care at children's hospitals. So if you want to donate to them, go to bitbybitfoundation.org. And that will do it for this episode. Josh, thank you so much for joining me.
No worries at all. My pleasure.
And I will see you all next time.